You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. Hey, you're back here with your hosts, Pat from Lifelong Shuffle and Dave from Strong Money Australia, for your next episode of Fire and Chill. So our mailbag is full again, and so we thought we'd do another listener question episode. Don't want to be just talking at you. We want to get your questions, try and solve them, try and work our way through them, talk about them. So it's good to have these episodes every once in a while because they just keep us thinking as well, and hopefully you guys can keep sending in these questions for us.
And it brings up like a lot of the questions that we get, what I'll say, probably common questions that you can almost guarantee that whatever question you have, someone else has got that question too. So don't be shy with sending those questions in. We love answering them, and hopefully we can provide some value by having them on the show. So before we get to that, actually, Pat, the last time when we spoke in the housing episode, we almost didn't finish one of those little discussions we were having about home loans. So at the time, you hadn't yet decided whether you were going with a fixed rate home loan or a variable home loan. And now that your property is almost settled, what did you end up going with and why?
I went with a variable rate home loan. And the reason I went with it was because on the same lines as what I was talking about last time, TikTok may operate a bit differently to other lenders. It's still not 100% clear to me. But I do believe that if you can get on the lowest variable rate now, while rates are at their lowest, even with RBA increases or lending cost increases, you might still be on a better foot than some of the new rates that are offered in the future. This is probably a wild stab, but that's what I've went with, and it gives me the most flexibility and the most options, so that's where I'm at.
And it's probably fair to say that driving your decision was the fact that there's not a huge difference between the fixed rate and the variable rate. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that would be fair to say. The TikTok offers extremely competitive rates. TikTok don't actually sponsor us at all, guys. So this is purely just us talking because I use them. Yeah, and very competitive variable rate. Super transparent on how their home loan rates have moved through the last 3 or 4 years for all of their customers. So that's all sitting right on their website. What customers that bought in 2016, got into the home loan in 2016, what their rate is now. So it's not kind of smoke and mirrors. It's all right there for you to see.
There's a lot of detail on there that I haven't seen on any other lending website at all.
No.
It was quite surprising to see how much detail they went into to explain where the rates come from and how what affects them and all the rest of it.
Yeah, really.
That was pretty interesting.
Really quite refreshing.
Yeah. All right, so before we get into questions, if you've got a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, you can send those in to fireandchillpod@gmail.com and we will feature it in a future listener questions episode. All right, so let's get started with the first question. And just so you know, we do edit these a little bit for simplicity, just to make it a bit easier when reading out and discussing it. So the first one is, I love your podcast and I'm so glad I found it. And I only took a few days to go through it all. That's pretty impressive. Hey, Pat?
Oh, that is super impressive. I don't think I could go through all our podcasts in 1 or 2 days.
No, definitely not. So the question is, how do you get past never believing you have enough knowledge? I took the plunge and bought some shares in 2018. Most have done pretty well. After that, I moved towards a property strategy due to having a secure career and a good income. However, the more I read, the more I believe I should continue down the shares path, but I never believe I have enough knowledge no matter what I read. I've been sitting on this for months, so how do you make the jump knowing that no amount of knowledge is ever going to be enough? I think this is a pretty common question, Pat, that we probably all struggle with, even if we don't say it out loud.
Yeah.
We all kind of struggle with this feeling of like, oh, I need to know more. I need to get to this other level of kind of knowledge or wisdom that other people seem to have.
Just make it perfect because things seem so permanent when in fact they're not. You can change things as you go and learn as you go. Nothing's ever as permanent as you're making it out to be in your mind. So I think what helps making the jump to start investing or continue investing is understanding that even suboptimal decisions are better than doing nothing. And that's where I come from a lot of the time. I know that I don't know everything. I know that I'm going to make suboptimal decisions often, but those suboptimal decisions are still way better than sitting on the sidelines for months or years just waiting to perfect your decision making to get the perfect investing portfolio, which is in itself probably not possible.
Doesn't exist. Doing nothing, it's like a decision in itself. Like just by default, you're deciding to do nothing because you feel a bit paralyzed. So it'll create its own outcome if you were to just stay in that kind of stuck stage.
Yeah, exactly. You can probably get to an 80% good choice with a few moments or a few days of looking into it and then just work your way from there. Whereas to get that final 20-30%, like perfect it, will take you the next decade.
That's a good way of thinking about it, actually. I think if you take me and Pat, for example, we both know that there are a lot of people out there who are much smarter than us, whether it's in investing or whether it's in helping other people, but that doesn't stop us from doing anything ourselves. We know that we'll continue to learn as we go, and we like to share those things with other people as we continue on our own journey. And being a good investor is like being a good saver, in the sense that once you know and understand and can implement just a few key lessons or a few key principles, and you have good investing habits, just like good savings habits, the progress will come from that. You don't need to know everything, and you can't know everything anyway. So that's important to remember too. So I'd say the number one thing is probably just to keep taking action and keep learning as you go.
Yeah, I agree. And as you get some money invested or more money invested, you just pay attention to these things more naturally. Like you learn more because you have some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. So instead of being paralyzed into doing nothing, get some exposure after you've done a bit of research and then just keep moving along from there.
Yeah. And I suppose on the information side of things, as you absorb more information over time, things will just start to click into place in your mind, because you'll be probably reading different sources of information, and there might be a underlying theme that kind of comes together in your brain and kind of makes sense to you. And so another thing is, when you're reading, I think it's important to actually take some time and absorb what you've just read rather than moving on to the next thing. Because if you've got 10 things to read and you're rushing through all of them, you may as well not have read any of them, because you're not really... Well, it's true, man. You're not really absorbing, because I've done that myself.
Yeah.
You read and read, and you haven't... After you've finished, you haven't really... You're like, what did I learn from that? You can't really think of anything. But I noticed that if I stop after I've read something and just think for a moment, what was the message of what I just read, I'm able to retain information better and I get more out of it. Hmm. So by reading less and taking a bit more time, you can actually get more out of what you've actually read in the first place.
Yeah, pretty cool.
All right, so we move on to the next one?
Yeah, another one about getting started investing. What to buy when you don't know where to begin? So this is a similar question with this theme quite a few times now. Someone who's getting started, wants to invest long-term in the share market, isn't sure really what to do. They just want something simple where they can put their money into each month and forget about it. What is our opinion on this? Our unprofessional, unsolicited advice?
Yeah, so I think this is really common as well. And it's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, because even though we're super interested in finance and investing, I'd say most people out there aren't. They get that they should do something and they want to do something, but they don't know where to begin. And then they get a bit overwhelmed, which kind of feeds back into our other question about, you know, a bit of this information overload and analysis paralysis.
This really depends on just how into it this person is. So I know, for example, I've had a few people in my personal life who've been interested in investing. They know that I'm into investing myself because of the podcast, and I don't really keep the whole thing a secret at all. And depending on who I'm talking to, I'll tailor the information I give them. So some people, like, they couldn't care less. Like, they just want it to be as simple and as straightforward as possible. And for those sorts of people, the easiest option is always these all-in-one diversified funds, namely VDHG by Vanguard for aggressive portfolio, or DHHF from BetaShares for an equivalent very aggressive portfolio. And that's just super easy. Okay, this is what you put your money in as often as you can, but save up a bit each before you put it in each time, so you're not being killed in brokerage. And that's the simplest advice I can give to someone I know.
Yeah, and I think that having just one thing to do and one thing to focus on makes it so much easier for people out there who don't have the interest or the time or the energy to dedicate to something like this, because that will still give you a good, like a pretty good long-term, you can be confident of a good long-term result from investing in a fund like that. So for someone who wants to keep it simple, that just makes so much sense. There's no hurdles in the sense that they don't have very much to learn. You can basically explain to them what they're investing in pretty quickly, which is essentially a basket of index funds from Australia and the rest of the world. And there's no real management involved. It's all done automatically, and they just buy whatever they can each month or each 2 months and reinvest their dividends, and there's not much to do. So it's really awesome from the simplicity point of view for people.
Yeah, exactly. And this would really cover over 90% of people who want to get into investing one of these funds. And it's only really the other 10%, which are perhaps a bit more interested, a bit more, they want to, I don't want to say juice, but tweak their portfolio to be a bit more suitable. So an often a tweak that a lot of people who are more interested like to make would be to reduce the Australian exposure, because the Australian exposure in these funds are around the 30 to 40% mark, whereas a tweak that someone might want to make would be to reduce that to 20%. So they do individual ETFs to do that. Or they might want to lose the 10% bonds in VDHG. So they might tweak that out of it. But this is really for the super interested small minority of people.
And when you separate, say, Australian shares and international shares and have those as have multiple funds rather than just one fund, it becomes, I won't say a lot cheaper, but if you've got a lot of money invested, it becomes a decent bit cheaper in terms of the annual fee that you're paying on your portfolio. So that's like a minor benefit once you have substantial investments that you get from separating the funds essentially and managing it yourself and having more. But still, the simplicity of having it all in one for someone who isn't sure what to do and just wants to get started, it's, you can't really find something that's that easy and that kind of diversified, wrapped up in one little packet for you to buy each month.
And still very cheap. Wow, we're really just burning through these, Dave. Let's keep this up, eh?
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to question number three. And this one is really about when to invest, and it's from someone who is beginning their FIRE journey. I have set up my portfolio and have rearranged my mortgage to free up some cash. I'm wondering how to break up my cash over a few months to average out the price of my stock purchases, or should I do this over a longer period? So this is really about, this is basically the question, should you invest a lump sum straight away or should you invest steadily over time? So what do you think about that, Pat? Another super common question too.
Very, very common from people who do find themselves with a lump of cash all of a sudden. I actually am from the train of thought that you probably are better dollar cost averaging over time, not because it'll give you the highest possible return, because the research shows that just investing it all at the start will be the most likely course of action to take to give you the highest possible return. But I look at dollar cost averaging as a form of insurance almost. So you're giving up a small amount of expected return for a greater reliability of getting a positive return. So I actually, given a lump sum of money, I would often suggest a dollar cost averaging because it leads to a position of least regret, especially if someone's new to investing.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. I think it depends. Sometimes the details matter. It depends how much cash we're talking about. If it's $10,000 and this person is also saving each month, it's probably not super critical if they, it's probably not a big deal if they were to put in that lump straight into the market and then they're still going to be buying each month anyway. But then it also depends on how comfortable that person is with the share market in the first place.
Hmm.
If they're just wanting to get started, but they're not quite at the level where they're comfortable putting that much money in, then obviously that's not going to be a good idea for them because they're not going to feel good about it. As you said, the research shows that most of the time putting it in all at once is better, but psychologically it is so much easier to put it in on a monthly basis and spread out those purchases maybe over, depending on how much money it is, but maybe over a 6 month period or even a 12 month period if it's a really substantial amount. And that will help to reduce any regret. You can have regret going both ways. So if you put the lump in and the market goes down, that can lead to a lot of regret. But if you were deciding to dollar cost average and buy every month, but the market takes off, you'd probably have some regret of not putting the lump in at the start. So you can think about it either way. And I suppose you have to consider which of those two things would you regret more. Yeah, so I would probably lean towards doing it on a monthly basis, like you said, Pat. But then there's also another option where you could probably put in half of the lump straight away. And then the other half you kind of drip feed over 6 or 12 months or whatever that is. So I really think that it's more of an emotional decision than a number crunching decision, because when the share market and volatility is involved, it can be pretty emotional for a lot of people. So I think there's definitely the psychological aspect to consider before you decide one way or the other, which option you prefer.
Yep.
Okay. I would love to hear your thought process on deciding between investing in unhedged versus hedged funds when looking at a global index fund for the long term. Thanks so much for a great podcast. Okay, I'll go first. I don't really think too much about this, to be honest, because I do expect that maybe half or more of our investments or assets will be like Australian assets for the foreseeable future. So that means I don't really need to hedge my international shares, and in fact it's probably better that I don't, because by having unhedged international shares it gives me a bit more diversification, because you would often find that when markets fall the Aussie dollar also falls, which means those international shares will be worth more in Aussie dollars. But obviously if the market's going down they may not be worth more, they may just not fall by as much, so they hold up a bit better.
Yeah, relatively speaking.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if I were to choose hedged international shares, I wouldn't get that benefit. So that's for my situation. If I was going to invest something like 80% of my money overseas, then I would definitely want some sort of hedging in the portfolio, because I don't want most of my money or most of my investments to be exposed to currency fluctuations, because obviously I'm living in Australia and living on investments, and I don't want the currency to go the wrong way against me. So that's probably what I would do. But I suppose the other thing to consider is when you consider it over the long term, the currency movements do tend to even out. So it depends on your time frame too and your situation, whether you're in retirement or not might also influence this decision. And then, as I alluded to, it depends what your portfolio looks like, whether you'd want to choose hedged or unhedged international shares. So that's my thoughts on it. Pat, what do you reckon?
So you've really touched on an important issue here, which didn't come out in the question. So it looks like the question asker is thinking about their global index fund in isolation, whereas you really can't do that. You have to look at your entire portfolio makeup and your spending to understand how much of your portfolio you should hedge. So going back to your example, Dave, with the situation you're in, because a lot of your assets are in the Australian share market, you've essentially already got half your assets, say, already not hedged to the Australian dollar, but they're in sync with the Australian dollar.
In Aussie dollars, yeah.
In Aussie dollars, correct. Whereas 80% of my portfolio actually is in international markets. So it's something I have already had to consider. And exactly like you said, I definitely want the diversification benefit of having assets in overseas currencies, because as the Australian dollar dives during market downturns, recessions, those assets hold up better and they buffer the fall quite a lot. But by the same token, I don't want to be in retirement and then all of a sudden the Australian dollar drops 30, 40, 50%. And then I have 80% of my portfolio lose 30, 40, 50% of its value in Australian dollars in one year or in 6 months or however long it takes for the Australian dollar to dive like that.
It'd be the other way around. Australian dollar would be going up.
You're right. Yeah, sorry. I always get these things wrong.
It's easy.
They cross wires in my mind. So what I do personally is I've got 20% in Australian shares, 10% in emerging markets. So I've got 70% in my global developed markets. So I go 45% unhedged and then 25% hedged, which gives me a total portfolio that is 45% in Australian dollar denominated assets and 55% in international denominated currencies, which works. I think that works well. And again, it gives you a part of the portfolio to draw from depending on what the dollar and the market is doing. So if the value of the Australian dollar is dropping heavily, then that means my international part of my portfolio should be doing relatively well compared to the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And likewise, vice versa. If the Australian dollar is really climbing a lot, then I've still got my Australian shares and my hedged international that should be doing relatively better than the rest of my portfolio.
And how did you decide on that kind of breakdown? Because that might help answer people's question as well. It's roughly half-half. Was there any kind of
science?
Master plan behind that, or just got that kind of feels about right?
Yeah, there was no science. There was no master plan, unfortunately. I just did. I wish there was, but I did tons of research and there isn't a whole lot of definitive research or scientific information about it. Everyone just agrees. Like, it's just something you have to work your way through and think through. There's no hard and fast answers. Mm. Like you said, it does all come out in the wash in the end. But there can be long periods of time where it doesn't. So we're talking years or decades where the value of that portion of portfolio can either take a huge dive for a long period of time or take a huge hike for a long period of time. So it is the common advice that because it comes out in the wash in the end, you don't need to worry about it, I think is incorrect. Because the old saying this doesn't really apply. Sorry, the old saying doesn't apply. I was going to say the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. Kind of the same concept.
Yeah, you can see how that kind of theme would apply, because if you've got most of your money in overseas investments, you don't want the currency to be going against you for too long if you're reliant on that portfolio to be living on. That can make a big deal. So, yeah, you don't want to be in that situation where things are going against you for such a long period of time. So if you have most of your investments overseas, you definitely want to protect against that kind of risk.
And just to put this into perspective, let's say the Australian dollar is buying 60 US cents, and we'll use the US market as a good proxy for the exchange rate strength that the Australian dollar has with the rest of the world's currencies, especially since most of the global investments are in the US market. And you retire with like 100% of your portfolio in international assets, and you have $1 million. Let's say over the next 3 or 4 years, the Australian dollar strengthens to 90 US cents in a dollar. Like, that'll wipe out, is it 50% or 33% of your portfolio value in that time frame?
I don't know. I can't do those maths straight away.
Yeah, okay.
A decent chunk.
A huge chunk of your portfolio value in the meantime in Australian dollars. So the companies will still actually be worth what they're worth in US dollars. But
your local purchasing power is a lot worse.
Is a lot worse, yeah. And then if you're selling some of those assets to live off, you're now having to sell more of those assets to make the same income in Australian dollars. And that can be very difficult if you're relying on that portfolio.
Yeah. Yeah. So I suppose the underlying message here is it's good to have exposure to international investments, but you definitely don't want to be in a position where you have mostly international investments in international currencies when you're spending in Aussie dollars and you have that risk of things moving against you in retirement. You definitely don't want that.
It's all about risk mitigation sometimes.
Yeah. So I think we probably can agree that around about half, I wouldn't feel comfortable having less than half Aussie dollar assets.
Somewhere around half. I have slightly less than half myself, but I would probably start feeling very uncomfortable if it was 30 to 40%, less than that.
So what did you say 45% you have
in
Aussie dollar assets? But what about your 5% cash?
Oh, that's right.
Is that counted?
No, it isn't. No.
There you go, 50%.
I haven't worked the cash into my portfolio yet. I'll start doing that in the months and years to come.
Okay, yeah.
And I'll start to think about it a bit more. But you're right, that should affect all of it. Yeah, okay, we can leave it there. Short episode.
Fine. Yeah.
It's fine. More than fine.
All right, that pretty much sums up our answers to these questions today. It's given us a bit of a chance to expand on these topics that you might have wanted more information on. And some of these things don't require a whole episode in themselves, so it's good to answer these questions in these listener episodes. If you do have a question that you'd like us to answer on the show in a future listener questions episode, you can send those to us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And remember, there are no silly questions at all, so you can ask us anything. And if you've been enjoying the show, we'd love it if you could share with a friend who might benefit from listening to the show too. And to the people who've already shared it or left us a review, thank you very much. We do appreciate those a lot. Thanks for tuning in today. We'll talk to you next time.